This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is novelist and short story writer Barry Hannah. Larry McMurtry has called him the best fiction writer to appear in the South since Flannery O'Connor. William Styron described Hannah as an original and one of the most consistently exciting writers of the post-Faulkner generation. Hannah writes about the American South. He grew up in Mississippi and has taught for many years at the University of Mississippi. He has won the William Faulkner Prize, been nominated for an American Book Award, and was a National Book Award finalist. The title of his new book, Yonder Stands Your Orphan, borrows a line from the Dylan song, It's All Over Now, Baby Blue. There are orphans and guns in the novel, and plenty of evil, as a killer changes the lives of everyone around him in a small Mississippi community. Hannah wrote the novel while getting chemotherapy treatments for lymphoma. Let's start with Hannah introducing a short reading from the book.
This is Man Mortimer, who is the evil that lurks in this book, and he likes to cut people. He comes from Missouri. And there's a little piece about him. At this juncture, he had no plans to hurt people around the lake. He did not like bodies of water much, had never seen the ocean. He was indifferent to trees. Soil was hateful to him, as was the odor of fish. But like many another man, 45 years in age, he wanted his youth back. He wanted to have pals, sports, high school girls. This need had rushed on him lately. He lived in 3 houses, but he had no home. He did not like the hearth, smells from the kitchen, an old friend for a wife, small talk. It all seemed a vicious closet to him. He moved, he took, he was admired. But he had developed a taste for young and younger flesh. This was thrilling and meant high money. Men and women in this nation were changing, and he intended to charge them for it. Religion had neither formed nor harmed him. Neither had his parents in southern Missouri. But he despised the weakness of the church and of his parents, whom he had gulled. He was a pretty boy born of hawk-nosed people. It was a curse to have these looks and no talent. Long, lank, hooded eyes, sensual lips that sang no tune. Still, he quit the football team because of what it did to his hair, claiming a back ailment that had exempted him from manual labor since age 14. There are thousands of men of this condition, most of them sorry and shiftless, defeated at the start. Many are compulsives and snarling fools, emeritus at 20.
Is this character of Man Mortimer based on anyone?
No, he's not. He's a compound, and I've gotten, just by looking around and believing that I perceived evil in front of me. So it is imaginative, but a collected history of my impressions, I believe.
You describe him as a quiet man, a gambler, a liaison for stolen cars, and a runner of whores, including 3 Vicksburg housewives. Describe his kind of crime.
His kind of crime is the kind of crime that begins out of laziness and being admired by women. He finds he can make a living at it, and he continues since he ran away from home in high school. He's not been particularly violent, but he has induced violent suicides in others. He is a thief. He has a stolen car ring, especially expensive SUVs. He's a man who doesn't like to work, and he doesn't like much of what's offered by nature. So I feel him as an alien without real pals and only a commercial connection to women. He wants to join in society now, but he only knows how to hurt, and that's the base of the book. Evil when it reaches out to you and when it befriends you. And in Mortimer's case, he likes to use a knife. He's dangerous, and he has made quite a deal of money off the casino life around Vicksburg.
Why did you want to create a character who embodies evil?
I have been fascinated with how evil goes unpunished, even unseen, in this life. And I wanted the evil to work on a group of folks I have already imagined in my short stories around a beautiful lake of my youth. And I thought the evil that Mortimer represented would give each of them decisions to make. And it would give a focus to their lives. So that I suppose I am just interested in evil and what it does to folks in a community.
Has evil like Man Mortimer's kind of evil ever come into your life?
I've been around it. Usually evil is something you can't face. It simply has to wear out. Sometimes you work for evil unwittingly. And I can't think of a particular person right now, but I think I've felt the closeness of evil in casinos. And it brings out the old Baptist in me. I find the wretched excess and the sort of zombified folks that attend and participate in casinos pathetic and also dangerous in many cases.
Now, what about violence? There's some violence in this book. Have you ever... Has violence come into your life? Have you witnessed it? Have you ever had a violent streak yourself?
I like to throw knives back in my drinking days, but no, I've never been personally violent. I can't be an honest man, though, and tell you, but that I am occupied by violence. It seems to be out of my nightmares, and my wife wishes I wouldn't write about violence, but as soon as the pen starts going, I become interested in it all over again, and it's as if it's almost dictated to me, because I've been writing for 35 years, and it's attended a good deal of my work. At this point, I don't think I can do anything but confess that I am a student of violence, because of what it does. Because of how it quickens the character of those around it.
You've also collected guns, right?
I've collected guns, yes.
And have you used them? What kind of things do you use them for?
I have not used a gun in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
If I used them right now, I'd shoot beer cans at the city dump. It's a 22 rifle. No, I don't have any real personal urge to shoot anymore. It just passed. And I've never shot at a human being, never threatened a human being, if that's covering the subject.
So what did you use the guns for?
You know, this is a difficult thing to explain to others about how a gun is a piece of art. Guns are history. I like to look at the mechanism. I like to feel the heft. And they are a kind of history. So that's about all I can say. I don't collect guns anymore, but I'm not sorry for the ones I have. They just feel like a decent hunk of the past hanging on the wall.
You say that whenever you pick up the pen, you end up starting to write about violence. What is it, do you think, about violence that's so seductive in fiction or in movies? And, you know, I wouldn't compare your new novel to an action film, but there just seems to be something that people gravitate to in stories of violence.
Yeah, they gravitate toward it. By the way, I have done calm pieces, meditative pieces, even religious pieces, and that are without violence. But I Don't know why the preoccupation, especially, except that it wakes up my imagination. And I may be a tragic case. It may be that the good does not light up my imagination as much as the evil. It may be a personal failure. But I am trying my best to get through this phase, and I do love hard drama, and I will imagine it in different ways, in several ways in the future, I'm sure.
My guest is writer Barry Hanna. His new novel is called Yonder Stands Your Orphan. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Barry Hanna is my guest. His new novel is called Yonder Stands Your Orphan. Everyone in your book is quite damaged in some way or another. Why is that?
Well, you know, I noticed the New York Times reviewer said that this book was a parade of gargoyles, and there are damaged folks in it. I think that people are needing to mend around a lake. A lake is a great contemplative body for me, and lakes have soothed me all my life. And I think that the wounded and those in despair might naturally gather around such a lake to live. I do not think my characters are particularly grotesque. It is my honest view of how folks live. And I have those fans of mine who don't really see them as terribly eccentric or painting them as obsessive. They think they're looking at life straight on. When you look at all of us, you're going to find a kind of private hurt that can be monstrous, and our private obsessions are very strange to others if they knew them. That's about all.
Now, I think you wrote most of this novel after being diagnosed with lymphoma, and some of it while taking chemotherapy treatments. Were you feeling kind of particularly damaged yourself when you were writing, physically damaged?
Yeah, and that probably contributes to the themes of damage in the book. I hadn't considered that, but my wife read the book, and she said, you know, this is very dark. And I had told a buddy of mine, very close to me, Dan Williams, you're going to have fun with this one, Dan. There's a lot of exuberance. And when it was finished, it was darker than I knew. I do think I was writing out of some real obsession with mortality and physical pain and on steroids some of the time. Well, the steroids were my only energy. They're the only drug that kept me standing during the chemotherapy. But I believe that you're right on the money. I do think my occupations were with death, with those facing hurt, and I also hope you don't miss the humor that saves us in the book.
Mm. How uncertain has the outcome been of your treatments?
Well, it's been good. I mean, I've been without cancer for a year.
Good.
And so I'm a hopeful and happy and very grateful man.
How do you think the exhaustion of being sick and taking chemo affected your will to write, your ability to write, the style that you wrote in?
You know, I really can't answer for that. I know that much came in a rush, private inner rushes, and that it was composed in tranquility that became a little more panicked and more panicked as I wrote, because I got deeper into treatment and into weakness. So it was a book that may be paced beginning with kind of a healthy or just a clinical observations about folks, and then it becomes maybe more frantic.
It takes a lot of endurance to write. I mean, I think it's a pretty exhausting, mentally exhausting occupation, physically not so much so because you're just sitting in a chair. Were you surprised at how much energy it took to write?
Yeah, I've never been this weak in my life. And I was shocked by weakness, which just accompanies the treatment. And I agree it takes a lot of energy and a lot of muscular strength. I mean, I use a pencil, and I love all of these tools, but it never had occurred to me what a vast physical job writing was until this book. Because in my earlier books, I had trouble keeping up with my pencil. The stories were coming so hot and heavy. In this one, this was a rather long and very exhausting view into a force that weakened me personally. I had 100 pages more than this book was, and it was cleaned up and helped beautifully by my editor, Amy Hundley, and by my wife also. My wife typed the manuscript. I was, for the first time in my life, very, very dependent on the women around me, and very beholden and full of love for these people.
Let me get back to your novel, Yonder Stands Your Orphan. There's a bar in which the novel opens. It's called the Walnut Bar. I want you to describe this bar.
This bar is one of the few surviving. I'm turning the pages now. I'm looking into what it is. It's a roadhouse, really. It's with a little bait. He's the man who still has roaches for bait, which is just really unheard of since the 50s almost. But he's a wise man in the ways of fishing. He advises folks on depth and lures and the wind. He's a bard. Men come there because it has none of the trappings of a woman about it. It has a calendar of a naked, bosomy girl on the wall, and it evokes the 50s around the Korean War. So it's where men gather in different places in the South, to be men and to talk manly. And it's a rough place, but it's also kind of a church. The bar is Walnut. As far as I know, it's unnamed. And it also is unlicensed. So the sheriff allows it or disallows it to be open. What it is a mecca for fishermen. And every fisherman I know who's serious about going long distances to fish will know something about a roadhouse like this.
Whereas I know nothing about a roadhouse like this. And I don't know whether it's because I'm a woman or because I'm from the North or because I'm from the city. But, you know, I was reading this and I'm thinking, I've never had the experience of being in a bar like this.
There's no reason why you should, Terry. I wouldn't go in there if I were a woman. There's nothing attractive unless you fish and you just see a sort of rugged charm about the folks. It's pretty pathetic, really, on its own merits. But he does have good whiskey, which he overcharges for, and he's got tales. He's telling stories about people around the lake. So he is kind of the Homer of the place. And the people are disappointed in him, in fact. He's now got a videotape he's selling behind the counter, which is close to child pornography. And it's the two men that we're introduced to, Robbie and Cecil, are sad that he's joined the modern times. But we find, of course, that Man Mortimer himself is doing local films with orphan girls. It's not an attractive place. There's no reason for anybody to go there except rough and kind of manly fishermen who are trying to get away from everything back at the office or the hardware store or wherever.
Barry Hanna will be back in the second half of the show. His new novel is called Yonder Stands Your Orphan. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with novelist and short story writer Barry Hanna. His new novel, Yonder Stands Your Orphan, is about an evil man, a killer who changes the lives of everyone in a small community in Mississippi. William Styron has called Hanna one of the most consistently exciting writers of the post-Faulkner generation. You grew up in Mississippi. You still live in Mississippi. What are some of the things you think most separate Southern culture from Northern culture?
Oh, Gad. I think they're still relatively unhurried here when you get out of the big urban centers like Nashville and Atlanta, which are very cosmopolitan now. They're very much like a lot of the nation. But there's a world of difference between a football crowd and at a Vandy Ole Miss game and a Penn State crowd. I can tell by experience. There is just a leisure about the culture and a kind of love of jokes, and especially old times. People in the South are nostalgic by age 11. And I say that in the book, but it's not a joke. It's looking back even to poverty as a great old time. We have a great yearning for a softer, quieter, kinder times. I think we're just afflicted with that Irish look at the past as a comfort and a joy. And we celebrate the past a great deal more than other places.
Did you grow up like that, always looking back?
I certainly did.
On what? What were the things that you were brought up to be nostalgic about?
My mother was from Delta Planters, and I heard her stories about boats coming up to their plantation full of oysters and candy and mint, and it sounded like an outpost in Africa. And I mean, my mother was, you know, born back at the turn of the century, 1906 or something, and it was so happy, Christmas time, so happy to get these things up from New Orleans on a big boat. It sounded like the best times available. I'm just sounding happy. And I listened to those stories, and now I am just as nostalgic as my mother for very modest homes down on the coast of Mississippi. Very sweet people with no money, a lot of gentility, natural, and affection for family. I had a very wonderful youth, and I was babied as a late child, and I had every opportunity to be what I wanted to be, and one of the best things they gave me was pleasant and gentle memories of family.
Describe where you grew up.
I grew up in Clinton, Mississippi, which is right outside the state capital in Jackson. But it was a distinct village, about 2,000 people, with a little college, a little Baptist college, so that we had professors and for neighbors, and the culture of the Baptist church, the high school band, and the football team. That was it. That was civilization as I knew it. Also, there was no crime. We disappeared sometimes in the summer at 8 o'clock in the morning, didn't come back until 7 at night. There was no fear because the whole village took care of us.
Did you go to the Baptist church?
Oh, yes, I did. Yeah.
What was the oratory like in the church, and do you think that influenced your sense of storytelling or the way you write?
The preachers did not, but the Bible itself has. The rhythms of the Old and New Testament in the King James Version are just as solidly set in a person of my era who went to church as a marble foundation. I make my sentences, I'm sure, from biblical rhythms. I've been called postmodernist, but I doubt it. I think I just write in more fragmented ways and narration, but the base of my sentences, although they are sometimes baroque, is, I think, from the scriptures, as far as I can feel it myself.
Was the Bible for you mostly an oral work that you heard preachers read out loud in church, or was it a book that you read to yourself?
Both. The preachers interpreted, and actually, the Protestant faiths have become almost Catholic in not reading the Bible. They become the preachers have become sole interpreters of the Bible, whereas the original Baptist idea was that every man was his own interpreter with no intercession. Yeah, we read a lot of the Bible. We knew scriptures by heart, especially Psalms and a great bit of the book of John, the Sermon on the Mount and from Matthew, and certain things like that were memorized. And I had them memorized until I was 15, 16 years old.
Can you think of a line or a passage from the Bible that has the kind of rhythms that you're speaking of and how they influenced you?
Yes, it's something like the 23rd Psalm. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow, and so on. This has just such wonderful, basic human poetry in it. And I never was sophisticated enough to consider the Bible as literature until I never even heard the term the Bible as literature until I was way into graduate school. So I'd stopped going to church, but the church is, the scriptures are very much with me. And more now, I'm reading Mark and John in the Bible. Not all the time, but I just love the clarity and the mystery at the same time.
I know when I was young and the Bible was read out loud in our assemblies every week in grade school, and when I would hear, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want," I was all just confused. Like, well, why wouldn't I want him then? I didn't realize that want could mean lack.
Right. You would want.
Yeah, why don't I want him? Yeah. I shall not want. Okay. Were you ever confused by the language?
I was confused constantly. Either the Southern pronunciation on things or the preacher's interpretation of things. I always adored Christ. That never has left me, but I was totally confused by God. And I remain confused. But I give large attention to Christ, and I do believe, like Thomas Jefferson said, the best code of morals we've ever had. And that goes deep into me. And if you get sick and there's nothing left but for you, but Christ and a few pals, you tend to become deep in your religious mind. I had an inner vision of Christ after a week after I almost died of pneumonia. And I didn't expect it. In the dream, I said, I haven't been paying enough attention to you. And he was very physical. And he made no comment. But he gave me to believe that he was there. And it just shocked me. Because I've not been a very wonderful Christian in a pronounced way. But he is still there deeply in me. I know part of it is cultural. But also a great deal of it is very real.
My guest is writer Barry Hanna. His new novel is called Yonder Stands Your Orphan. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Barry Hanna. His new novel is called Yonder Stands Your Orphan. Did you grow up reading a lot of the literature of the South? Did the fact that you were from the South affect your choices in what to read or the things that you were assigned in school?
I did not read the literature of the South. I only heard the great names spoken, Eudora Welty, William Faulkner, Tennessee Williams. I was not literary a bit, frankly, until I went to high school. I got a high school class and started reading some Keats. And then I think next was Jack London. So I'm a schooled literary man. It wasn't just instantly available in the house.
What was it about Keats that did it for you?
I think it was the Ode on a Grecian Urn, and I had such a good teacher, Mrs. Lois Blackwell, that made that thing come alive, and I could see the joy in language and how somebody could get rapturous over beauty. And also knowing that he died at 26 interested me because I was like 17, and that seemed like a pretty decent lifespan then. So you just get to move on. You can get your poems in, die at 26 and be famous. So that was actually kind of inviting to the stupid boy in school like me.
Did that give you also this romantic sense of an early death?
It may have. It may have. And I've since shed that.
Right.
There's not a damn thing glorious about tuberculosis, and everybody who knows that disease knows that it should be de-romancified, as they said about Orwell, who had it too. It used to be the writer disease, and I kind of even wanted it. You know, anything to get you to pure ecstasy in words, I thought I was willing to bear.
So you thought fever could give you a vision?
Right, right. Fever and then liquor for several years. And so I went my way in liquor, which is almost a boring story with writers. But I thought you needed it for insight. And my heroes had become Faulkner and Joyce and Hemingway. We all slugged it back. And I thought it liberated vision. And it does make you more comfortable with saying anything you want to. It may have made me a little funnier, sometimes a little wittier, but the fallout was negative, as it always is, if continued.
Well, some people have a constant editor sitting on their shoulder. You know, there's an editor part of their own personality that's always silencing the writer, and it's a very inhibiting experience. Did you have that, and did alcohol get rid of the editor?
I think you've just put your hand on the exact problem. Yeah, it made me better at parties. It made other people more interesting, as Jack Nicholson said, giving the reason why he drank. You were just a happy old thing, and the same thing when you sat down to the typewriter. Your inhibitions go away. And I think if you can limit it to like two whiskeys, there's something to be said for it. That you are looser, and you actually are friendlier to the universe and more inviting to strangers, and you can imagine other people a little better. Now I just have coffee, and I think I do it pretty well, but I do want to caution the young that it's you neither want alcoholism nor tuberculosis nor any of the things that have killed off many wonderful people like Jimi Hendrix, and whom I still miss. You just got to gut it and be more stubborn and trust your own head.
Were you an obnoxious drinker? If you had too many, were you difficult?
Sure. Sure, especially in the last years. I haven't had a drink in 11 years, but, oh, yes, I lost a marriage because of it. It's everything that's in the book. It's unbearable, especially as you grow older. An old drunk is really a pitiful thing.
Barry Hanna is my guest, and his new novel is called Yonder Stands Your Orphan. Have you ever gone through a real dry period writing where it just wouldn't come and you gave up?
Yes. But I think that's what it's good to teach and have a regular paycheck, because I go for some months without inspiration, and it frightens me. It frightens me deeply. Nobody wants to be out of gas. Nobody wants to repeat himself. So these are frightening times, and I was keeping a journal to try to help myself. I've heard that it helps, but my journal was full of such banal thoughts, I wouldn't dare let anybody read them. I'm just like taking out the dog, and it's raining today, and I had no great thoughts unless I was working. And that's the way it's been. I just don't think. My thoughts are very average, ordinary, until I get among people and language. I think I do have some thoughts then, and there's my real work, my mental life. You just wait out these periods. I think it's good. You know, there are already too many books, and you want to save it until you're ready and you can do your best. And then when those days come, that's just a wonderful feeling, because you got to get up at 4 in the morning and full of joy go into those notebooks, and I just feel like I'm the luckiest man in the world.
You mentioned before that you've been cancer-free for a year. Do you still have to take any kind of treatments?
No, not, unless it recurs. And even then, there are new drugs to help me along. And I kill the cancer. So I don't know how to feel, frankly. I have the attitude of a healthy man, but I'm not quite healthy yet. And I just remain grateful that I got to do this book we're talking about, and that I'm talking with a pleasant and intelligent woman like you. I'm not gonna, there's nothing to gain by my coming on to you at this point, but I do appreciate it. this is nice. This is very, 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 very nice, and I'm flattered by your attention.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
You bet.
Barry Hanna, his new novel is called Yonder Stands Your Orphan. This is Fresh Air.